Central and African, but not a republic. Today, Tuesday, November 26th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Chaos in the Central African Republic. Then again, chaos has long been a trademark of this often neglected country, starting in the 70s with the rule of its longtime dictator.
This self-styled emperor who thought of himself as the Napoleon of Africa and sort of dressed like an extra from Sergeant Pepper and spent zillions of dollars, the entire country's wealth, on his own coronation.
And later, a poetry slam in Jordan draws more than just lovers of verse.
We always have people from intelligence at the shows recording everything on their phones.
Plus how Robert Frost found his poetic voice in England.
Now, why England? Well, I think sometimes a writer needs separation to begin to hear his own voice, the accents of home.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When I lived in Africa in the 1980s, a book called The Africans by David Lamb was the guide I often turned to. Lamb had great stories to tell, also some pretty hideous ones, like his account of the Central African Republic, which is where we begin our show today. A military coup has led to chaos there and warnings of a possible genocide. Back in the 80s, it was still recovering from the rule of Jean Bedel Bokassa. He'd crowned himself emperor and was said to practice cannibalism. And here's a great quote Emperor Bokassa gave Lamb about his country's finances and its former colonial ruler. "Everything around here is financed by the French government. We ask the French for money, we get it, and waste it." Bokassa's rule ended in 1979 when French paratroopers took him out of power. Fast forward to today. Again, talk of French troops landing in the Central African Republic, or the CAR as it's called, this time to try and prevent carnage. The battle lines in the country seem to be drawn along both religious and ethnic lines, but the bottom line is this. No one seems to be in control in one of the poorest countries of the world. Rebels and government militias are exacting violence, torture, rape, execution on anyone who gets in their way.
The population is absolutely terrorized. All the world must know that there are inhuman acts here that are not normal, and that those who stand by are all accomplices to this.
That's a priest named Father Frederic Tonfio. Tens of thousands of people have sought refuge in his church, northwest of the capital Bangui. Clearly, one church can't save a whole country, which is why France, again, is considering military intervention in the CAR. Here's French Foreign Ministry spokesman Vincent Floriani speaking to the BBC.
The country is really out of control. People are talking of a situation which is on the verge of genocide. The country could drift into sectarian violence between Christians and Muslims. And this is what we want to avoid.
Floriani says the CAR cannot cope with the violence.
You have a population of about 5 million people and only 7 surgeons. Thousands of people are being killed. This is really a terrible situation.
The emergency chief of UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, is in the CAR. Bob McCarthy says the results of the fighting are deeply discouraging.
Number one, there is no protection, so people are forced to live in the bush. They're living in extremely difficult conditions. Many of them have wounds. The situation for children is bad. They don't have enough food. And they're really fleeing for their lives.
As we said earlier, there's no government to speak of, allegiances that are hard to define. Many worry that the next phase could be violence on a mass scale. Today, the UN Security Council is considering the possibility of a French-led peacekeeping force in the Central African Republic. But New Yorker staff writer Philip Gurevich isn't optimistic that the French can bring stability to their troubled former colony.
The fact is that probably nobody else is interested, and France has been very gung-ho to reestablish itself as the sphere of influence leader in French-speaking Africa since it was really pushed to the margins after the Rwandan genocide and the fall of Mobutu in the 1990s. They've reinserted themselves very strongly, taking a role in the Ivory Coast first militarily, the action in Mali. They were driving force, obviously, in the Libya campaign, and now going into the Central African Republic, where they have a very ugly history. Giscard d'Estaing, when he was president in the 60s and 70s, his first state trip was to go visit President Bokassa this self-styled emperor who thought of himself as the Napoleon of Africa and sort of dressed like an extra from Sergeant Pepper and spent zillions of dollars, the entire country's wealth, on his own coronation, which he got the French marching band to, march down the streets of the capital while his people suffered endlessly. Giscard, the president of France, was given his own private hunting areas. He hung out with this emperor all the time. He really fetishized him. And by the time that Bokassa was then overthrown, in turn, by the French-backed military operation, he started complaining that, Giscard d'Estaing was sleeping with my wife, the empress. It's that kind of messy. It's wow. Hard to know how any long-term good can come from it. But if the situation's as grim as it is, it's also hard to not hope that somebody can find a way to alleviate the most extreme suffering.
When you were covering Rwanda's genocide in 1994, it turns out one of the first people you met in Rwanda was a UN employee from the CAR who'd been in Rwanda through the genocide. What do you remember about your conversations with him and about Central African Republic?
It was literally the first guy I met in Rwanda in a year after the genocide. I flew in and there were no taxis at the airport. And I got a lift from this guy in a UN car. And he turned out to come from the Central African Republic. He had been with the UN mission in Rwanda. And he said, I was here through the whole thing. I am disgusted with this country. It struck me very strongly because I said, with the whole country? And he said, yeah, I'm just disgusted with it. And I thought, here he comes from the Central African Republic, a pretty dysfunctional state with some very horrible history. What does it mean to say a whole country's hopeless? And I thought, you go to Rwanda now, and Rwanda's a relatively model country for safety. And so many people at that time would have said it's impossible. So that when, people say to me, is it just hopeless in the Central African Republic? It's missing a lot of the ingredients one would like to see for hope. There aren't forces within the country that you can identify at this point, whom you can look to and say, if they could establish order, you could start to have governance and you could have this country running itself. It's more like Darfur, I would say.
In what way? I mean, explain that parallel.
Well, in Darfur, you had this escalation over several years, and then you had an intervention force that was able to staunch that, but not really to establish anything like a viable system. Part of the problem was the Sudanese government and its allied militias, the largest part of the problem. So you don't look to establish state control when the state's the problem. People live in Darfur. There are huge numbers of people still living in camps. There's meddling from neighboring countries. And so what you have is a kind of stalemate. And compared to the most violent mayhem that one saw in Darfur, this is preferable. But as anything like a longer-term solution, it's really not very promising at this stage.
Do you think there is a connection to kind of post-independence dysfunction in a country like CAR and its colonial, former colonial overseers?
Oh, sure. The French enabled the worst behavior and, as I said, glorified people who were appallingly abusive leaders and who were doing this on the French dime and with the French support. This is obviously different. They're going in now under UN auspices. They say they're going short term. They're doing it, I would say, as much to launder their image in Africa in terms of their own political interests as it is to also establish or reclaim a certain kind of influence. One has to keep in mind that there are two issues. There's the immediate desire to contain extreme violence and to prevent an escalation to something very much worse. And then there's the question of how does this place sort itself out? And I think it's important to be very clear that a deployment of 1,000 French troops under a UN banner with some neighboring African Union troops is not that. It's a very temporary response. It's fireman work.
Philip Gurevich, staff writer for The New Yorker. He's also the author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, a book describing his travels in Rwanda after the genocide there in 1994. Philip, thank you very much, as always.
Good talking to you, Marco.
You'll be hearing a lot about what the United States and our partners just achieved in Geneva. So I wanted to take a minute to share with you an inside view of what we really accomplished here.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry in a YouTube video published today where he explains a nuclear agreement just reached with Iran. In the video, Kerry counters the criticism that the agreement lets Iran off the hook without really halting its nuclear program. He stresses that the deal is just a first step.
And our diplomats and our experts will be at the negotiating table very soon again, working to achieve this final comprehensive agreement that addresses all of our concerns and our friends, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the Arab Emirates, others. The whole world has an interest in making sure that this is a peaceful program.
Two countries Kerry didn't mention there, Afghanistan and Pakistan. They're both just over Iran's eastern border, and there are thousands of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, so there may be regional implications to the Iran deal as well. So says Vali Nasser, dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
Afghanistan and Pakistan has been a declining interest for the United States. The United States is set to leave that region, and it probably might feel now more comfortable doing so, because if it has an agreement and an understanding with Iran, and if U.S.-Iranian relations begin to stabilize, probably the United States will have less to worry leaving Afghanistan, thinking that it is possible to have a tacit understanding with Iran about relations in Afghanistan.
Are you a little surprised, then, that there isn't more attempts to try and triangulate the Iran deal on its nukes and, you know, the wind down in Afghanistan right now?
No, I'm not surprised, largely because the U.S. administration is not very good at triangulating. We approach these issues as if they're in complete isolation. And I think if anybody tries to triangulate the nuclear deal with anything these days, it's with Syria rather than with Afghanistan. And that's also largely a consequence of the fact that we think that we have a plan and the plan is in place and there's no need to touch it. This is not an open issue that needs to be revisited, whereas some of the other issues like Syria still don't have closure. And therefore, we might think more broadly that Iran may be relevant there. I don't think the United States is really looking to change its story about the end game in Afghanistan at this point in time.
I'm curious to know what you think of National Security Advisor Susan Rice, her trip to Kabul over the weekend. It seemed to be kind of a quiet visit. The White House didn't really draw any attention to it. Why was she there?
Well, the National Security Advisor is the president's direct representative. So this is as close as you can have a conversation between the president of the United States and the president of Afghanistan. And I think she went there largely because the security deal is at peril. Karzai is playing politics with the future of the United States in Afghanistan. He's casting doubts on whether or not the plans for U.S. departure in 2014 will be as we thought they would be. And I think there was some degree of pressure on the United States to intervene quickly, to talk to Karzai, and to keep the plans on track and make sure that things don't unravel. I think it may very well be that given that the United States can claim certain success in Geneva, it might have more latitude in basically pushing Karzai by telling him that if he doesn't play by what he agreed to with the United States, then we may very well wash our hands of Afghanistan, given that now we have better relations with Iran.
Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan, as we indicated, are all in the same region. What opportunities are there for striking, say, small bargains on this regional chessboard that may be missing right now?
Well, partly, I think even a tacit understanding between the United States and Iran over Afghanistan will help stability in that country. It may deny Karzai the ability to play Washington against Tehran. I think improvement of relations between the United States and Iran may put back on the table the idea of a gas pipeline between Iran and Pakistan. It may facilitate greater trade between Iran and Afghanistan. If Iran's role in Afghanistan and Pakistan becomes formalized and approved by the international community, then that benefits stability in those two countries.
Vali Nasser, dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Still ahead, reading slam poetry in Amman on the World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Think of the European Union as an exclusive fraternity. Membership is not easy. add strident politics to the mix, and it can get very complicated. Take Ukraine. It wanted to join the EU, but now its bid is on pause. Why? Well, that's where this story starts. And here to explain is Nina Kuryata with the BBC's Ukrainian service. So Ukraine was supposed to sign this accord later this week with the EU for membership. Now the president's reverses thinking. What reasons is he giving for this change of heart?
Viktor Yanukovych says that Ukraine can't sign the agreement now, but he is sure at the same time that Ukraine has the European prospect. So the main message is like, we will be in Europe, but not now. He says that Ukraine didn't have enough financial support from the EU. And on the other hand, Russia pressed Ukraine not to sign the agreement.
Can you elaborate on what that means? Russia pressed Ukraine not to sign the agreement.
It was clearly said to the Ukraine governors that if you guys sign the agreement, no more economical and trade relations with Russia can be discussed. So you just refuse to sign the association agreement, and then three sides, I mean Russia, EU and Ukraine, should sit down and discuss it together. That was Russia's point, which was explained today.
And I gather those trade relations hinge heavily on Russian natural gas deliveries to Ukraine, which seem probably pretty critical during winter months. Is that right?
The main tool is Russian gas, because Ukrainian industry depends very much on it. And the other one is Russian market, because, as you know, Russia can ban different goods from Ukraine, like chocolate, cheese, milk products, etc. So the trade wars are being made constantly, and we do not know what to expect next, but the main problem is Russian gas indeed.
So I gather protesters are out again in the streets of Kiev today. Are these protests growing, and what are the protesters saying about all this?
There are a lot of young people who say that they will defend their opinion and they will not give up, because our young people who are protesting now, they consider themselves to be Europeans and they just want to go in this direction. The protest is termless until the problem resolves, as the people say. Yesterday, for example, it was like 10,000 of people, but last Sunday, it was 100,000 of people, and the next Sunday, there will be another big meeting, and we will see how many people attend it.
The Ukrainian Prime Minister says he doesn't want Ukraine to be a battlefield between Russia and the EU, but this does feel very Cold War-like.
Yeah, exactly, it is. And he also said that the students can dream, but they cannot understand the economical reasons. So all Ukrainian governors say that economy is crucial and EU hasn't gave enough money for them. And that is why we should stop and think once again.
I mean, how much more tense will this whole Ukraine-Russia-EU thing get?
Well, nobody knows, but this is definitely, you know, the play on nerves, because the doors of EU are not closed for Ukraine. They are still open. But the Prime Minister, Mykola Azarov, said that Viktor Yanukovych will go to the Vilnius summit, but just to set up the conditions of the three sides negotiations, like Russia, EU and Ukraine. And I don't think European side likes that, because Europe doesn't need Russia in EU-Ukraine negotiations.
Nina Kuryata with the BBC's Ukrainian service. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Flurries today in Boston, a melancholy reminder that winter is coming, brings to mind a bit of Robert Frost. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the Village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. This week's Sideways Glance takes us a little north of our newsroom to the White Mountains of New Hampshire and the home of America's poet. Okay, you're thinking, what's the Robert Frost international angle? The world's Nina Porzucchi, take it away.
This story begins with a plank of wood.
You want to see it?
Yeah. There it is. Madel Driscoll directs the Frost Place, Robert Frost's old homestead in Franconia, New Hampshire. Recently, as she and her staff were cleaning up the house and packing away for winter, they found something odd wedged into a closet under the stairs.
This is what this appears to be the crate lid. As you can see here, it says, for SS St. Paul, sailing February the 13th, American Lines, Ford. I can't read from upside down. Can you read it?
Please, something
forward with dispatch.
Yeah. That crate lid, Driscoll realized, was no ordinary piece of wood.
He's carved here, R. Frost, Plymouth, New Hampshire, USA.
It was part of the crate that Frost used to sail back from England in 1915. Now, like many American teens across the country, I memorized Robert Frost in school. You know, two roads diverged in a yellow wood. But this quintessential American poet was actually a nobody before he set sail to England 3 years earlier. Nearly 40 years old, Frost was a college dropout, a farmer living in rural New Hampshire, and a poet, sorta.
He'd had one or two poems published, but only in a magazine, not poetry, but poultry magazine, a magazine for chicken farmers.
That's Jay Perini, a poet himself and biographer of Frost. Frost's time in England, says Perini, was crucial to Frost's entrance into the American canon. And it all came about on a bit of a whim. Frost inherited some money, and in 1912, he sold his chicken farm and packed up his family and set sail across the Atlantic. With only a letter of introduction to an obscure British poet, Frank S. Flint, he was determined to infiltrate the British literary scene. And somehow, he did.
Within the space of a year, Frost had met Yeats, Ezra Pound, the poet Wilfred Gibson, the poet LaSalle Abercrombie, and lots of other poets and editors.
The American Unknown published his first two books, A Boy's Will and North of Boston, and was heralded by his British colleagues for capturing the American voice.
Why England? Well, I think sometimes a writer needs separation to begin to hear his own voice, the accents of home. And so in the very American-accented poetry that he wrote during this period, you can hear the voice of the New England farmer being miraculously transformed.
Like the voice of the farmer in one of his most well-known poems, Mending Wall, written, says Perini, during the poet's stay in Kingsbarn, Scotland, a landscape full of stone walls and farms. But it's a New England landscape at the center of the poem and a New England colloquialism that you might recognize in Frost's reading of his poem.
He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me. And I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors?
Without his experience in England, suggests Perini, it's unlikely we'd be memorizing a poem about a road in a yellow wood. Frost left England in 1915 as World War I ramped up.
When he stepped off the boat in America, walked up to the dock, he saw a copy of The New Republic, which had a big story. New American voice, Robert Frost, poet of the people. And so from that moment on, Frost was Robert Frost, famous American poet, beloved American poet.
But the now famous literary figure didn't head to New York City or Boston. Nope. He settled down in the quiet village of Franconia, New Hampshire, where he presumably unpacked his things, shoved them into a closet under the stairs, and I guess just needed a little extra shelf space. For The World, I'm Nina Porzucchi.
This is The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, an Italian photographer documents refugees' first nights in America. He remembers one Somali family who had a hotel room, but they didn't want to stay in it.
They were afraid of being left behind, and so they decided to spend the night in the hallway. They had a room, but they just didn't trust that people would remember them once the door was closed.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. They set the date for a new round of Syria peace talks, but there's little to indicate that either rebels or government forces are ready to budge. And on the ground, the war has turned into a bloody stalemate, except for one breakthrough in northeastern Syria. That's home to most of Syria's Kurdish population and most of the country's oil resources. 2 weeks ago, Kurdish leaders declared that they'd set up their own provisional government. Marine Olivezi is just back from Syria's Kurdish region and sent us this report.
So we just arrived about half a mile away from the front line. There's not much to it at first glance. There's no exchange of fire, no shelling. But what makes this place so different is that here, the Syrian army, the regime of Bashar al-Assad, is on neither side of the front line. A 20-year-old with a scruffy beard points to the enemy at a distance. Al-Qaeda brigades, holed up in buildings just a few football fields away. This man is one of the 50,000 fighters of the YPG, the Kurdish militia in Syria. Like him, most joined the force in the past 2 years. They're not really fighting for or against the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Their enemy now is the Islamist groups that have attempted to take over this largely secular part of Syria. The tiny farm he's guarding was in the grip of Al-Qaeda militants until earlier this month. Abdul Karim Omar is a spokesperson for the People's Council of Western Kurdistan, a political coalition that backs the YPG.
YPG, its name, you know, it is the units of protecting people, protecting or defending people, not attacking. And all the battles that we took is in our lands. We didn't go to Deir ez-Zor or Raqqa or Aleppo and attacking them. Just we defend our people in our land.
While the Kurds have long been sidelined under the Assad regime, the recent offensive was celebrated by non-Kurdish Syrians, including Arab villagers, who've turned to the YPG for protection against the Islamists. Aluk is an Arab village of 100 or so mud houses surrounded by cotton fields. It's the last hamlet before Ras Al Ain, a city that had been for months at the center of the standoff between Kurds and radical Islamists. The Nusra Front and the Islamic State in Syria, two Al-Qaeda-linked groups, stormed Aluk in September and set up their base at the school. Hassan Munir Al-Shehab, a teacher, remembers the date. It was September 14, just a few days before school was scheduled to start. He says about 300 jihadists spread around the village at dawn. Hardly any of them spoke Arabic.
Such people from Malaysia, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, has nothing to do in our country. They have nothing to do here, only damaging and destroying.
Hassan and his family fled. They later returned to a ransacked house. The village elder says he's grateful for the help of the Kurdish militia.
Kurds and Arabs were all together in the same trenches. Before this problem, we were already in good terms, but this strengthened our relations even more. The YPG fought to protect us and didn't want anything in return. I trust them more than my own son.
After the clashes, some Arab villagers even joined the YPG. Half a dozen men now man the checkpoint outside of Aluk, most of them Arabs with Kurdish weapons. The jihadists retreated, but they're by no means gone. Over the weekend, three car bombs rocked the Kurdish town of Qamishli. Al-Qaeda fighters also planted landmines and set up booby traps when they pulled out. Thirty-year-old Mahmoud was killed a week ago by one such device. His sister wails as they lower his body into the ground. The funeral turns into a political rally and a military parade. The day also marks a year since the assassination of Abed Khalil, a journalist and prominent Kurdish activist who was shot by an Islamist sniper. He was one of the first casualties of this war within a war. Dozens of freshly covered graves now surround his tomb. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi, Ras Al Ain, Syria.
You can see Marine's pictures from the front lines in northern Syria. We've got a slideshow at PRI.org. The war in Syria has displaced millions of people. Many have fled across Syria's borders to places like Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. And the number of Syrians seeking asylum here in the U.S. has increased sharply over the past year. The World's intern, Emily Files, has a story of one 19-year-old Syrian who's now waiting for asylum in Massachusetts.
I met Fuad Ferris at a restaurant not far from his new home near Boston. Over coffee, he tells me about being in a protest in Aleppo, Syria.
The regime started dropping tear gas, yeah. And then I started crying. I couldn't be able to breathe, and my lungs started to hurt me, and I couldn't see anything.
That was about a year after the Syrian conflict started. Ferris was 17 and going to dental school. Most days, life was pretty normal. He'd go to classes, hang out with friends. But then there were days when he went to anti-government protests and days when the government pushed back. There was also fear, he says, of getting snitched on or arrested at a checkpoint. And then, around August of last year, things intensified in Aleppo.
Real war, like the tanks start to come over, aircrafts, everything. Two bombs dropped just 20 feet next to the house. I didn't realize what was the first one, just heard a noise and like smoke. And my sister was next to me and she said, oh, it's a bomb. I said, no, it couldn't be a bomb. And when I was saying it's not a bomb, the other one fell down too. And then I realized it's really a bomb. And then I told her, okay, go inside. We can't just stay here.
Faris and his family left Syria, and now they're split, states and continents away from each other. Faris's sister Rama tried for a U.S. visa but hit a snag, so she's with family in Turkey now. Faris's parents are in Alabama, where it's cheaper to live with their three youngest children. Faris got his U.S. visa, but instead of meeting his parents in Alabama, he went to Shrewsbury, outside of Boston. It's where he has an aunt and uncle, and he thought he'd have more to do there. At least once a week, he talks to his sister Rama online.
But I want to come into America because my family in America, but I don't have luck. It's kind of hard.
Luck. She doesn't have that.
Luck. I don't have good luck. Yeah.
Faris knows he's lucky to be here, but he's in his own limbo too. He's still waiting for U.S. immigration to process his asylum application. It's been more than 7 months now. Until he gets his papers, he can't work, drive, or enroll in college here.
Sometimes I feel so lucky, and sometimes, like, I feel lucky at all. I left my perfect life there and came here.
Your perfect
life? Yeah.
You think it
comparing to my life here, I have nothing here.
But you have
I have
safety.
No commitments here. Like, I have safety there, too. In my own vision, it's safety for me. I can take care of myself, and I can avoid the problems, I can avoid the anything.
Faris says that, but he knows there's danger. He hears news from back home of friends and family getting arrested or kidnapped. After being sheltered in a quiet suburb for a year, he feels a mix of boredom and guilt.
There's no difference between me and those people. We're all the same. Why they have to suffer while I'm not? We're both Syrians. We're both from the same town. We're living the same neighborhood. What's the difference? Why them, not me? We're all equal, right?
Faris spends a lot of time on the computer trying to keep track of what's happening in Syria, talking with friends there, following news on Facebook. He waits for asylum and the day he'll be able to go back home.
Most people my age now, they would care about gaming, getting new phone, getting new car, getting or hanging out, or all the stuff. Or for me, all I care about is to go back to education or get a job or do anything. Because it's my home. You're not used to anything beside home.
Before I leave, he shows me a song on YouTube. It's one of his favorites about Syria called Jenna Jenna. He translates.
It's like, our home, you're a heaven.
Later on, Faris sends me a text message. It sums up how he feels in a way he couldn't express aloud. He writes, is it a real chance to start over? Or is the universe punishing us for being born in Syria? I see neither a gift or a curse in what's happened. But, he writes, the thing I'm sure of is that we all got tough because of everything we've been through. For the world, I'm Emily Files.
In a few minutes, a photographer who's documented the anxious first nights of refugees on American soil. First, though, we want to take you to an Arab country that has somehow avoided the convulsions of the Arab Spring and its aftermath in the region. That's not to say everything's fine in Jordan, or that people there aren't trying to push the envelope when it comes to freedom of expression, like the young women who are part of the Slam Poetry Underground in the capital, Amman. Two of them joined us on Skype from Jordan. First, Nadine Ajaka. She's a Lebanese-Canadian who went to Amman on a Fulbright scholarship. She wrote about the city's slam poetry scene for the Daily Beast.
I heard about a slam poetry event just on Facebook. You know, social media is in the Arab world, I think, especially, is just kind of how you hear about everything. And so I went to this open mic night that was happening at this tiny art space. And I remember going there, and it was packed with people. And I saw the poets go up one by one, and I was really moved by the sophistication of the poetry, just the beauty of it, and also by the fact that virtually all of them were young women. And I remember thinking, you know, what an amazing venue this is, what an amazing opportunity this is for these young women to express themselves.
Well, let me bring in Aisha Shamaila into the conversation here, who is the founder of the slam poetry group, this female slam poetry group. You're probably not too surprised by what Nadine found, Aisha. You were born in Jordan, you came to the U.S. society, and then returned to Jordan. Why'd you decide to launch a slam poetry event?
I was very heavily involved in the spoken word scene in the U.S., and I slammed for 3 years, and I have 2 national collegiate titles, and I'm a World Youth Slam finalist. So, like, I considered myself a professional spoken word artist. I went back to Jordan, and, you know, there was nothing. No one knew what that art form is. And I think for me, the reason why I started this group is because the experience of being introduced to spoken word poetry was very empowering. Like, it gave me a voice that I had never known I had, and I never knew I could use to also empower other people. And I thought it was, like, very important to give it to, like, Arab youth.
Slam poetry is so honest. I mean, it's often in-your-face honest. Did you ever get any pushback? Did you ever any experience about, you know, Jordanians not comfortable with that kind of honesty?
First of all, I have to say that I've seen so much support in Jordan. I was surprised. I was very, very nervous when I started doing my poetry here, because specifically, like, my poetry sometimes is very, you know, uncensored and very personal. And there were a couple of moments where I think, you know, people were uncomfortable with the idea perhaps of me being a woman, an Arab woman, also doing poetry in English, in a language that the average Jordanian does not have access to. You know, there is a sense of privilege there. And also the idea of me talking about my personal life. Like, I've talked about being exposed to, you know, sexual harassment as a child. I've talked about domestic violence. And I think those topics are very taboo in the Arab world. Like, even if we know that they happen on a daily basis, we just don't talk about them. And so I think a lot of people appreciate that, the majority do, and I'm sure a couple of people are just like, what the hell is this girl doing?
And Nadine, you wrote about this underground female poetry slam scene for the Daily Beast, and you spoke with some of the audience members. What kind of things were they telling you?
Sure. I think this is a really kind of new and exciting thing for people who are involved in the art scene and observers of the art scene in Jordan. Rap in the Arab world has kind of been loud and around for a while, but slam poetry is very new. And it's a new, and also, unlike rap in the Arab world, it's almost exclusively dominated by women. I hear from a lot of people what an interesting thing it is to see, and it's raw and it's inspiring. And I think anyone that's witnessed spoken word poetry can attest to that anywhere in the world.
Aisha, Jordan never went through its own iteration of the Arab Spring. I'm wondering how you think that affects your ability to be more visible in Jordan with your poetry.
This past year has been very difficult for Jordanians because the state is very worried about the Arab Spring arriving in Jordan. I think there has been a lot of state-sponsored censorship, and I've had friends and poets who actually were taken in by the intelligence agency and questioned, and their notebooks were torn apart. So I think for me, because of the Arab Spring, every time I do a show, I'm very scared about getting caught by the government, honestly, like, because we always have people from intelligence recording everything on their phones.
And yet you still hold these events. You still write poetry.
Yeah.
Why?
Like, so if I'm going to let fear take away my voice, then that's useless. You know, doing my poetry or, like, my art might not create, like, major drastic changes. I mean, I don't think I'm going to lead a revolution. But I think maybe if a couple people my generation start talking about what needs to happen, then, you know, that's a little contribution I can make.
Nadine Jaka and Aisha El Shamaila telling us about the underground women's slam poetry scene in Amman, Jordan. Thank you both very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you so much for having us.
And before the break, here's a taste of Aisha's poetry.
You say we don't harvest, we kill. Yet I drive past bodies heaping into hills. Memories wrinkling into young widows waiting by windowsills for a fleeting gesture to detonate into bloom. Stay. I am the woman who sailed with you once before. You called me your seasickness.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. What's it like to spend the first night in the United States as a refugee? Well, that's a question that an Italian photographer has spent some time thinking about and looking at. And his recent book, Refugee Hotel, is now the focus of an exhibit in New York. Bruce Wallace has a story.
Photographer Gabriella Stabila's closet in his Manhattan apartment holds an archive of his 6 years documenting refugees. Hard drives are piled on the top shelf. Below that are boxes with photo prints and Kodachrome slides. Stabila says that sometimes, when he's exhausted Netflix, he'll throw a tray of slides into a projector and look through old photos. He says he always finds surprises.
Well, see, this is a cool image. Right? You have, like, a Cuban refugee, which is the woman in the doorway, talking to her, another member of her family, that had been resettled to the States earlier on. So, you see, he looks much more American. He has, like, the cap, you know, the baseball cap and all that.
Other photos show other quiet moments. Burmese kids scrutinizing a Coca-Cola vending machine. A young Cuban refugee asleep in a chair. A man from Burundi gazing out an open door. These photos fill Stabila's recent book called Refugee Hotel. Some photos are also on display until December 22nd at the Bronx Documentary Center. The project started in 2006 when Stabila began going to hotels where some refugees spend their first night in America before traveling on to their final destinations. He photographed these brief moments of transition.
You could really feel the compassion and the fear, like the nostalgia, the uncertainties.
He also gathered stories. A Somalian family on its first night in the U.S. stands out.
These people that had a room like all the other refugees' families, but they were afraid of being left behind, and so they decided to spend the night in the hallway. They had a room, but they just didn't trust that people would remember them once the door was closed.
Amy Serre, who Stabila also photographed, did go into his room. He's a refugee from an ethnic minority in Myanmar. He didn't quite know what to make of the room.
We're scared to touch.
He says he and the guy he shared the room with were afraid to touch anything, and they weren't sure how to operate the shower. They figured it out, though.
We cleaned all the water, but, you know.
They cleaned up all the water and folded the towels back just like they found them, he says. In the morning, they carefully made up the beds. Then Annie Sarah flew to Charlottesville, Virginia. His parents and brother joined him there a few months later. The International Rescue Committee, a major refugee organization, helps many people resettle in Charlottesville. Annie Sarah's brother, Annie Mu, says there was a kind of refugee lunch table at his high school.
We just taught different language. It's like amazing. Somebody from Iraq, somebody from Tibet or China or Burma or Thailand, you know. A lot of people sit together. Even we speak English, sometimes we have a confusing. What do you say? What do you say? Sometimes we make fun to each other language because it is so fun.
Gabriella Stabila visited Annie Mu and his family 2 years after documenting Annie Serre's first night in the U.S. He was with journalist Juliet Linderman, who gathered oral histories, which are paired with Stabila's photos in the book and exhibit. After spending so much time learning about the lives of refugees, Linderman and Stabila are conflicted about the prospects of resettlement. On the one hand, as Linderman says,
most everyone that I talked to was so grateful to be in the United States because they were finally in a place where, for the most part, they feel safe, right? They feel free from fear. You know, they don't have to be afraid that they're going to be forced to flee where they're living.
But Stabila says they also found deeper scars, and he wants to convey that.
I think we undervalue the difficulties, especially psychological and existential difficulties that arise when you're displaced. Because displacement is a wound that doesn't really heal that easily. Actually, I think that doesn't heal at all. And I was more interested in seeing how they deal with that.
Annie Serre tells me that he still finds it hard to describe his nationality. His parents and language are from Myanmar, but he's never been there. He spent most of his life in a refugee camp in Thailand, but he doesn't speak much Thai, and he still isn't fully comfortable calling himself American either. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, New York City.
You can see what that first night in America is like for refugees. We've got a slideshow of Stabile's powerful images at PRI.org. What's your story of arriving in America? We're collecting them, inspired by the South Asian American Digital Archives First Days Project. Share your first day's experience at PRI.org. And finally today.
Hi, this is Manasa Piri in Lusaka, Zambia. And today I'm going to share with you the music of a very exciting young band from Zimbabwe called Mokomba, M-O-K-O-O-M-B-A, from the album Rising Tide. Mokomba is an Afro-fusion band that has exploded onto the world music scene with their very first album, Rising Tide. And the first track I'm going to share with you is called Njoka, a snake. A song about a snake from Makumba, and as you heard in that song, it's a fusion of Central African, Southern African rhythms spiced with a taste of West Africa. Unique thing about Makumba is that they don't sing in any Zimbabwean language. They actually sing in languages that are found in Zambia. They're definitely Zimbabwean, from the town of Victoria Falls in the north of Zimbabwe, bordering Zambia at the Victoria Falls. Here's another track. It's called Mvula, Rain. Let the rain fall, an Afro-rock rhythm, very, very reminiscent of the 70s Afro-rock sound of Osibisa and other bands. And then it goes straight into sort of 90s Congolese soukous, Mokumba from Zimbabwe. I'm going to go out now with my favorite track on this exciting album by Mokumba called Rising Tide. And remember, Mokumba are from Zimbabwe. And here they are singing about an old tribal circumcision rite of western and northwestern Zambia. This is Masangango.
Guest DJ Manasa Piri of Joy FM in Lusaka, Zambia there. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, on Twitter at Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. The Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.